From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headlee. We're going to talk politics on today's show. Now that the Republican and Democratic conventions are over, what is next in the presidential race?
America is a nation of believers, dreamers, and strivers that is being led by a group of censors, critics, and cynics.
Don't let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We're not. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do.
Plus, is Georgia turning from red to purple? Will Trump's candidacy accelerate or delay that particular trend? All that is coming up this hour, but first, alligator hunting is about to become a thing in Georgia. Turns out thousands of people are expected to apply for permits to hunt gators in the state. On Friday, we asked The Break Room if they had ever seen an alligator in Georgia. Former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr said that she spotted a gator while on a rattlesnake hunt. And let's all just take a second and absorb the notion that Kathy Lohr goes on rattlesnake hunts. But anyway, Kathy said that gators may be more common than you'd think.
In those same southern Georgia areas, there are gators. I mean, there was a gator in a park just, you know, locals were saying, don't go to that park because they'll be out there by the swing sets.
Yikes. We want to know if you've ever been confronted by a gator. The OSTM writes on Twitter, had a gator encounter on Cumberland Island, not sure who was more scared. And we got a call from Kathy Geeslin.
Several years ago, 10 miles east of where I live in Macon, Georgia, an 18-foot alligator basically came ashore because the Ocmulgee River had risen really high. And my niece in North Carolina has seen alligators. So all the North Georgia people who think they're immune, they are not immune.
No, they can get you. Be afraid. As far as eating alligator goes, Jason Ganesh tweets, I would and have before. The tail is tasty, light-colored and lean, but can be very chewy if cooked too fast. It's great in gumbo. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia politicians took to the stage the past 2 weeks at both the Democratic and Republican national conventions. Now a new phase of the presidential election is about to begin, and here to recap the conventions and give us some highlights, especially as they pertain to the state of Georgia, is Andra Gillespie. She's a political science professor at Emory University, and she attended both conventions. Good morning, Andra.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing okay. Just briefly compare and contrast the mood of the Democratic versus the Republican conventions.
Well, I'll say that both state delegations left the conventions pretty confident in their ability to be able to win the state. Overall, I think the tone of the conventions was different. The Republicans focused a lot on what was wrong with the country and on Donald Trump's ability to be able to fix it. And the Democrats tried to be much more optimistic in terms of their tone.
Who was representing Georgia at the RNC?
I spent a lot of time with the statewide delegation, and so in both conventions. And so you, of course, had your statewide party chairs on both sides. You had delegates who were active partisans on both sides. There were elected officials who were there, both Democratic and Republican, local party activists. I think probably the one thing that might distinguish the Democratic delegation from the Republican delegation was the fact that there were Bernie Sanders delegates who up until now had not really participated in politics before, who were coming to the convention and coming to formal party politics for the first time.
Right. But at the Republican National Convention, it was interesting. A surprisingly large number of the Georgia delegation were Black.
Yes. And so, you know, the numbers were really interesting. So going into the convention, there had been a Washington Post report that had said that there were going to be 18 Black delegates. And they said that the largest delegations were going to be coming from California and Texas, and then Georgia was going to be third. They said that there were three. And looking at the list going into the convention, I knew that that wasn't true. When we got there, that was when I got a chance to meet many of the African-American delegates. There were definitely more than three regular delegates, and then there were alternate alternates on top of that. So, yeah, no, it was actually incredibly diverse. And that 18 number might not have actually been the most accurate. And so there's still some contestation over it. I think once you add in delegates and you add in alternates, you are probably looking at it being more like 35, 36 black delegates nationally. That's still really, really low. But if you hung out with the Georgia delegation, it was actually somewhat diverse.
Any division among the Georgia delegates at the Republican convention?
You know, one of the things that was actually really interesting was, especially after Wednesday night when Ted Cruz refused to endorse Donald Trump, there was a discussion. And so I know that C-SPAN aired the Texas delegation breakfast, which got pretty heated. From my understanding, there were some heated discussions behind closed doors in Georgia. I didn't see it at the delegate breakfast. John Padgett just mentioned it the next day. And talking with some of those delegates, some of whom were not pledged to Donald Trump, they actually were really taken aback by Ted Cruz's behavior. And they really sort of framed it in terms of what's proper decorum at a convention. So, you know, in terms of the convention as coronation of the candidate, there are just certain things that they didn't think were actually the most appropriate. And especially like refusing to get up and endorse a candidate at his own convention, they thought that crossed the line, even if they had been supportive of Ted Cruz, the candidate. And so an interesting story about that. When Ted Cruz was giving his speech, I was actually helping a friend who was a journalist get an interview with a Georgia delegate. So I was actually in the hold, kind of below, only hearing the dull roar, not actually seeing it live and up front. But when I got kicked out of there and came back upstairs, it was all a buzz. So within a few minutes of Ted Cruz having made his speech, you could hear walking around the arena people talking about how upset they were and how uncouth it was for him to have done that.
Let's play a clip from one of the RNC speeches. This is from Georgia's own Newt Gingrich.
Donald Trump won our party's nomination because he is willing to tell the truth about the things that matter. He has a great running mate in Mike Pence. They will put our safety first, and they will defend America first. We can be proud to stand with them.
It's Newt Gingrich speaking at the Republican National Convention, and we're talking to Emory's Andre Gillespie, political science professor. Andre, are you surprised that Gingrich ultimately didn't end up getting the VP tap from Trump?
No. And so, you know, when we're thinking about the pros and cons of the candidates, Newt Gingrich could be considered because running with Donald Trump, I think, is still a risk for us, particularly young politicians. And so being at the end of his political career, Newt Gingrich didn't have anything to lose. But also, I mean, I think if you think about compatibility and think about complementarity, Newt Gingrich didn't necessarily bring that to the table. He's got as big a personality as Donald Trump, which could create conflict or clash. In many different instances. Also, Newt Gingrich doesn't necessarily look like the type of person who would be a second to anybody. And because they do have very similar personalities.
He wanted to be, though.
If you wanted to temper. Yeah, no. And I think he was actually willing to serve his party in that way because there were so many people who were kind of standing back and refusing
to do that. Oh, yeah. He came out and said it. I mean, he was campaigning for the job.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, and so I don't want to take that away from him. But, I mean, he's in a very different career stage than, say, a Joni Ernst or a Bob Corker who pulled themselves out of the race. But personality-wise, especially if Donald Trump's liability is the notion that he might not be temperamentally fit to be president of the United States, having somebody like Mike Pence at his side, who has a much more sober type of personality and is much more serious, actually would do more to assure the party establishment of the seriousness of this campaign than putting somebody with an outsized personality like Newt Gingrich up there.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Did you watch any of the convention speeches? How do you think that each party represented themselves? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Let's go over and talk more about the Democratic convention, and let's hear from former President Jimmy Carter. This is from a video message that played during the convention. The audio is a little bit sketchy here. Try to listen tough and try to listen hard, and I will try to help you out with it.
And I thank Senator Sanders for energizing and bringing so many young people into the electoral process. To all of you young Americans, I say, stay engaged, stay involved, and be sure to vote this November.
That's Carter there thanking Senator Sanders for energizing young voters and bringing them into the electoral process and urging young voters to stay involved even now that Bernie Sanders is no longer directly involved in this election. I should first of all note that David Weigel, who's a political writer that I like a lot, noted on Twitter that if Barack Obama lives as long as Jimmy Carter has, he will be addressing the Democratic Convention at least at the year 2052. Andra, can you imagine that?
That would be very cool.
Talk about the Bernie supporters that Carter was referencing there. How did they conduct themselves during the convention? Were there any disturbances beyond that first day when things were a little bit rough?
There were. So, you know, the first couple of hours of Monday night were rough. Bernie Sanders sent a message to his supporters to tell them to kind of cool it down. So if by late Monday evening you started to notice that the booing was dying down, it was because Sanders actually asked his supporters to stand down. Yeah, no, there was still some tension. There was some tension in the Georgia delegation on Tuesday when Sanders conceded the nomination to Hillary Clinton and asked for the vote by acclamation for all intents and purposes to nominate Hillary Clinton. There were some Sanders delegates who thought that when people started to chant Bernie, 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 that wasn't actually being supportive of Sanders, that was actually gloating. And they were very upset and they threatened to not come back. I can't tell for sure whether or not they actually made good on their promise to not go back. I certainly saw people with delegate badges. And I couldn't see. So I, you know, wasn't in a position to be able to verify whether or not they came or didn't come. But there were many walkouts. So, you know, after Hillary Clinton's name was put into nomination, Sanders delegates walked out and they went over to the media tent, which was outside the arena, and they staged a silent protest. There were was even a mini walkout on Thursday. And so you could see a small group of Sanders supporters who came out and they were chanting Jill, not Hill, so that they indicating their intent to vote for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. You know, I think that for Sanders supporters, you know, this was oftentimes their first time interacting with party politics and party rules. There are some things that definitely need to be addressed within the Democratic Party. So questions about whether or not rules were actually followed, questions about their perceptions among some Sanders delegates that the voting was rigged. And so we have to sort of, the Democratic Party is going to have to address those issues. And from a scholarly standpoint, we're going to have to investigate them from a nonpartisan, objective standpoint to actually see, you know, what the truth actually was.
Going to play a couple of clips back to back here. Here's Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed's speech where he takes a shot at Trump.
Tonight we choose diversity over division. We choose a steady-handed commander-in-chief over a loose cannon. We choose a leader who would rather be in the trenches, securing health care for 8 million children, than in a suite putting his name on a tower that he probably doesn't own. We choose something different tonight.
Burn. And now one more clip from the Democratic National Convention. Here's Georgia Congressman John Lewis during his nomination speech.
I've known Hillary Clinton for many years. She is one of the most qualified candidates to ever run for president. She is a leader, sometimes sailing against the wind to break down barriers that divide us.
Emory political science professor Andra Gillespie, 20 seconds. Is the Georgia delegation behind Hillary Clinton?
Yes. Overall, I would say yes.
Okay, that was shorter than 20 seconds. Well done. We're talking to Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. She's going to stay with us into the next segment. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in this week for Celeste Headley. Georgia has been a red state since the 1990s, meaning the state reliably votes Republican in presidential contests. Political analysts have been predicting for years that due to demographic changes, Georgia might go purple, that is, become a swing state where a red Republican and a blue Democrat would have an equal shot. The year in which Georgia would go purple has been a matter of debate among prognosticators, but 2020 is about as early as anyone dared to guess until Trump happened. How might this unprecedented election season alter the course of Georgia's political evolution? Here to weigh the odds is Daniel Franklin. He's a professor of political science at Georgia State University. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
And with us still is Andra Gillespie of Emory University, also a political science professor. Thanks for sticking around, Andra.
No problem.
In 2014, MSNBC host Chris Hayes reported on the possibility of Georgia turning a little bit bluer. Here is Hayes providing some historical context on how the state has voted in past presidential elections.
Since 1964, Georgia has voted for Republicans in every election with four exceptions. Infamous segregationist George Wallace in 1968, local boy made good Jimmy Carter in 1976 and 1980, and Bill Clinton in 1992.
And then, of course, Georgia went for Bob Dole in 96, and it's been a red state ever since. Daniel Franklin, right off the bat, do you think it's possible that Georgia's electoral votes go to Hillary Clinton this year?
It is possible, and one of the things to look for in this race is to see where the campaigns go to do their campaigning. If we see either one of the candidates down in Georgia doing anything other than fundraising, the Republicans are in real trouble because this should be a reliably red state. I noticed today that Hillary was campaigning in Nebraska. I'm a little surprised by that because Nebraska shouldn't be in play.
Andra, same question to you. Is it possible that Georgia goes Clinton this year?
I'm probably right now a little less hopeful about that. And so this is not my taking one side or the other. But the reason why I would be less hopeful about that is, one, we don't poll often enough in the state to have any reliable measures that I would say. So the last polls that I've seen in Georgia ended in May. So I think I would need
And they were showing a statistical tie, right?
And they were showing a tie, which is what gave Democrats hope in the state. So I think we would need to do kind of more reliable testing in the state in order to know for sure what was going on in the state. You know, there are a couple of things that I think mitigate, against that happening. I would still say Republicans have the advantage and that it's still their state to lose. I would expect that the drop-off in support for Democratic candidates that we would have anticipated kind of in a post-Obama election is probably not going to happen. And so you could see a Democratic candidate getting Obama type of numbers in this state. So the same way that Obama was able to mobilize the African-American vote, I would see Hillary Clinton being able to put parts of that coalition together. If the Georgia Republicans unite around Donald Trump, and they haven't completely united against around Donald Trump, but they've done a decent enough job of being able to do that, I could still see Trump winning the state by single-digit margins the same way that John McCain and Mitt Romney did.
Dan, do you look at the polling any differently from how Andrew looks at it?
Well, there was a fairly recent poll, the WSB poll, just came out a few days ago, and it showed Hillary down by 1 point. Now, the problem with the poll is—
with a margin of error of probably 3 or 4, 5
right,
points, right?
Right, right. And the problem with the poll is it's what's called a likely voter poll. So there's a model that they're trying to look at. They're trying to predict who will actually vote. And the problem with that is it's kind of a moving target. On the other hand, the likely voter polls are, pretty accurate. And also, I think if these polls are off, they're going to be off to the favor of the Democrats, because if Trump's done one thing, he's motivated Hispanic voters. And the fastest growing population in this state is the Hispanic population. And
we'll get back to that.
Yeah.
Andra, do you want to just start explaining to us what are these demographic changes that we have been talking about? Georgia's headed to a big milestone in the year 2018, right?
So when Democrats have been looking toward 2018, 2020, 2024, what they're looking at are changes in demographics. So they're looking at reverse migration of African-Americans back into a state that already had a large African-American population. We've seen exponential growth in the Latino and Asian-American populations. And in most recent presidential elections, these groups are voting over 70% Democratic. You also see an influx of urban whites who might not be attached to conservative politics. Perhaps they're from places outside of the South. Perhaps they hold more liberal values. And so this urban core of liberal whites, African-Americans, Latinos, and Asian-Americans is assumed to be the growth market in votes, as opposed to whites who have traditionally voted Republican. And so if the populations that are more inclined to vote Democratic vote, continue to do so, and their populations are growing and the white Republican population is shrinking, then eventually that should make Georgia more competitive.
And the year 2018 is the year at which demographers believe that Georgia will become a so-called majority-minority state. Dan Franklin, let's talk more specifically about those Latino voters. Donald Trump has fired up a lot of populations with the various things that he has said over the course of his campaign. He's said some of his most potent things about Latinos. Tell us about Georgia's Latino voters. Fastest growing segment of the population. How are they reacting to Trump? Are they all repulsed by him?
Well, the first of all, there's a couple things to remember. The turnout in Hispanic voters, among Hispanic voters, is generally, especially Hispanic voters of Latin American descent, has been generally pretty low, a lot lower than other minority populations, particularly African American populations, for a couple of reasons. First of all, because they come from an immigrant background, and you know, it takes a couple of generations to get acculturated to American politics. In the countries where their families came from, voting is either dangerous or meaningless. Yeah. And so, you know, it's the same thing that could be said for Asian voters, new immigrants from Asia. So the immigrant population is hard to mobilize. Trump's mobilized them, and the expectations are that they go sort of from 50% turnout, when the normal turnout in presidential general elections is around 65%, that they may go from 50% to 60%. And while that makes a lot of difference nationally, it'll particularly make a lot of difference in states that have larger Hispanic populations. For example, Arizona is in play. In fact, a lot of people think Arizona may go blue this time, which is, you know, puts McCain in a lot of trouble as he's running for Senate there. I don't think the Hispanic population is large enough in Georgia, even if there's a higher rate of turnout. I also think there's going to be some slippage in the African-American vote because of Obama's not at the top of the ticket. So that's why I don't think we're going to have a surprise this time.
My guests are Georgia State political science professor Daniel Franklin, who you just heard. Also with us is Emory political science professor Andre Gillespie. We're talking about whether it's possible for Georgia to turn from a red state to a purple state as early as this year. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Do you think that Georgia could go Clinton? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening right now at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Georgia House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams launched a group called the New Georgia Project to register new voters. It says it signed up about 69,000 voters before the 2014 elections. Now the goal is to register 170,000 more before the November election. Former NAACP President Ben Jealous told MSNBC that registering new voters is critical to the Democratic cause, registering new voters of color in particular. Let's listen.
There are 600,000 unregistered black people in the state and 230,000 unregistered Asians and Latinos on top of that. If we could just sign up 750,000 of them, it would be almost impossible for the Republicans to win again.
Andre, how realistic do you think it is that, hundreds of thousands of new Georgia voters could be registered before November?
Well, so, you know, Stacey Abrams is my state legislator, and I know people who work in the New Georgia Project. That being said, they, I think, are taking a long view, and I think they recognize that this is a long view. So I think it's absolutely important to register people to vote. But registering people to vote doesn't guarantee that that's actually going to get them out to the polls. So there's a difference between voter registration and voter mobilization. And the problem is when you have new registered voters, they tend to be unfamiliar with the process, unsure of themselves. They're actually going to be more likely to not show up and vote than seasoned voters. So you have to marry voter mobilization and GOTV with voter registration. The people at the New Georgia Project know that, but what that also does is that should temper the enthusiasm for demographic shifts automatically leading to a change. Doesn't say that it's not going to happen. This is a crazy election year where every prediction that we've made has gone wrong so far. Yeah. But in general, I would tell people to kind of temper their enthusiasm. I mean, part of the issue with 2018 is knowing that especially people a few years ago were banking on 18, 19, 20-year-old Latinos turning out to vote immediately. Well, that's just not how the life cycle process works. People usually don't hit consistent voting patterns until they're much older and much more settled into their lives, into their adult lives, I should say. And so I think that the same thing needs to be done here. But one of the things that's actually really important is part of the reason why Latinos and Asian Americans in particular don't turn out to vote is that they are actually less likely to report actually being directly mobilized by any group. So if there's any less lesson to be taken from this. It's that campaigns need to reach out to Asian American and Latino voters. And I should point out that in the Trump the Georgia delegation at the Republican convention, they included Asian American and Latino delegates too, and alternates. So, you know, this isn't, you know, despite Donald Trump's rhetoric, there are people of color who are going to support him. That should be taken as a response from both sides to make sure that they do everything that they can to get their message out and to try to persuade people as to the merits of their candidate.
And also not to forget white voters. Here's Stacey Abrams herself, Georgia House Minority Leader, talking about why it's important for the Democratic Party to not marginalize or forget white Democrats while trying to diversify the party at the same time. Let's listen.
As a minority, I understand what it means to make sure that you don't make the minority feel oppressed. And if you want white Democrats, if you want white people to be Democrats, you have to create a space so that their values are recognized, because their values are not that divergent from everyone else.
Dan Franklin of Georgia State, do you think it's possible that the Democratic Party could this year win not just some white voters? Sure, they're going to get some urban, educated white voters, but working class white voters, or is that a block that is forever lost to the party?
I don't think it's forever lost for the party. If one thing that the Trump and the Sanders phenomenon have shown us, it is that working class voters are very unhappy. And while we may not be able to adopt their solutions that they might want to solve their problems, we're going to have to think. I think it is going to be the challenge of the next generation of politicians and how to make life better for working class people. Now, as far as mobilizing voters in the state, the problem that the Democratic Party in the state is going to have is that the nature of our electoral college system is such that presidential campaigns generally have a first things first philosophy. In other words, you rank order the states in terms of how likely you are to win them and how many votes they have. And so it is not the case that the Democrats need Georgia to win the election. So unless
Georgia has 16 electoral votes? I mean, that's a lot, right? I think there's only
lot,
seven or eight states that have more.
But at the end of the day, you don't really need them to win the general election. If it becomes clear in the last few weeks of the campaign that Hillary is going to claim and that she's going to win easily, then she may go for a landslide. And the nice things about a landslide are that you can maybe pull some congressional candidacies along with you, although coattails have been very, very short in recent years. And so I think the problem is that the Georgians may be motivated, but whether the national party is motivated, that's something else.
So, I mean, I'll add here that I know that DeBose Porter did meet with officials at the DNC trying to convince the DNC that Georgia was going to be competitive and that there needed to be investment in this state. So we'll see if we actually see the fruits of that in terms of visits, in terms of advertising, in terms of campaign infrastructure. But, you know, the state party is trying to make that case to the DNC.
Yeah, I should say DeBose Porter is the chair of the state Democratic Party. Let's look down ballot from the White House race. There's a key matchup between Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson, longtime incumbent, and Democratic challenger Jim Barksdale. Dan, 3 months to go. How are things looking in that contest?
Well, I haven't seen any polling on it, but the reason why you don't see a lot of polling on it is it's not assumed to be competitive. Also, polls cost a lot of money, and the Barksdale campaign may be short. And the Isaacson campaign may not think that they need to do it. The problem the Democrats have in Georgia is in the last cycle, they ran very strong campaigns at both the gubernatorial and the senatorial level. They ran Michelle Nunn, a daughter of a popular senator and grandson of a president, and they got trounced. Yeah. And so the problem that the Democrats have is recruiting people who will run. What's the point in running? What's the point in spending and raising and spending $20 million, which is what you would need to run a legitimate statewide race in the state?
Right. And Barksdale is an independently wealthy guy, so it's not so much of a sacrifice for him.
Right. And you've got to find people who are willing to spend their own money, and then you have to make sacrifices in terms of their experience and maybe, you know, their name recognition, that sort of thing. So I think that what's going to happen is as the state turns, there's 1 year there's going to be a surprise. somebody's going to pick off somebody. And it could be this year, although I doubt it. I think Johnny Isaacson's very, very popular. And I think it's going to be very, very hard to beat. But one year there's going to be a surprise. And once that surprise happens, then the floodgates will open. People will begin to, more powerful candidates will begin to line up to run for positions down ticket.
Yeah, Andre, last thought goes to you. What effect, if any, do you see this crazy, this bonkers presidential election this year having on down ballot races in Georgia?
So, I agree with Dan that I suspect Johnny Isaacson's going to win. Democrats have talked about trying to punish him for tacitly endorsing Donald Trump and hoping that they might be able to make some inroads. I doubt that that's going to happen. I mean, I think the key here is what Stacey Abrams was talking about when she was talking about white voters, because the problem in 2014 was not minority voters. They turned out and voted the way that one would expect them to, particularly African Americans. The issue was that they did horribly among white voters. So the key for the DPG is to try to figure out how to reach out to white voters and to make them feel included in the big tent.
And we'll have to leave it there. Daniel Franklin is a political science professor at Georgia State. Andre Gillespie is a political science professor at Emory. Thank you both so much. Good analysis.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Hidley. This is On Second Thought. 2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize. And so we're going to spend some time with past winners of the Pulitzer Prize who are connected to Georgia. It's a new series that we are calling Pulitzer Peaches. Our guest this morning is journalist Bill Dedman. His series on the discriminatory lending practices of Atlanta's banks and mortgage lenders won him the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 1989. His stories were published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and we're honored to have Bill on the program. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Adam.
Good to have you. Can you just, first of all, summarize what were your big takeaways from your reporting? What were the heads that you mounted on spikes?
Well, we weren't really having barbecues of sacred cows, but the main shock to people was that in the city known as the city too busy to hate, that the banks and largest savings and loan companies were making loans, home loans, in middle income and poor white neighborhoods, but not making loans in the middle or upper middle income or upper income black or integrated neighborhoods. The map of where the Atlanta banks weren't lending money and the map of where black people lived in Atlanta were the same map.
Right. And this is a practice known as redlining?
Yes. And redlining implies a conscious decision, someone drawing a line on a map. We lend on this side of the line and not on the other. And we didn't prove that there was a conscious intent. And we didn't, in fact, I credit the explanation of bankers that they just didn't know that there was money to be made in black neighborhoods in Atlanta. They had made an association, a common association, that black meant poor. My eyes were opened. After our stories ran, I went along, bankers from Bank South let us go on a bus tour of some very affluent neighborhoods in South Atlanta. Guilford Forest was one. And you could tell, and the bankers were saying, hey, these kitchens are nicer than our kitchens. And they had no idea that these neighborhoods existed.
How did you collect the data to accomplish this piece of reporting?
Well, I could tell you about 8-inch floppy disks. It's been that long ago. you know, there had been a couple of academic studies in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, and what we realized was that if they could do it, we could do it too. And banks had to report then, and other anybody else that got deposits, like a savings and loan, had to report where they made loans by census tract, so you could match it up to the demographics. The key thing that we did was to not look at the poor areas and not look at the rich areas. We were looking at middle-income areas where people could afford homes. That was the key sort of decision that we made.
Why?
Well, because that was where it was comparable, and that was where you didn't have a debate about, well, can these people afford homes? There were homes being bought and sold by black Atlantans in those middle and upper-income neighborhoods. The market share, however, of the banks and the savings and loans was nearly zero.
How did you first get onto the story?
Well, you know, I was in a little neighborhood called South Atlanta with a Methodist minister I was doing a story, probably the required story before the Democratic National Convention that year in 88. About, by the way, there are poor people in Atlanta. I was standing in a relatively poor neighborhood doing a story about housing. And the minister was doing, he was building houses and then selling them to people. And he said, but they can't get loans. People here can't get loans in this neighborhood, even though their mortgage payment will be far less than they've been paying in rent. And I said, well, gee, this doesn't look like such a prosperous neighborhood. To me, I don't, if I had any money, I don't think I'd lend any money here. And he said, well, I can see your point in a way, but the banks in Atlanta don't lend money in Cascade Heights either, in Hank Aaron's neighborhood. They don't lend money in Adams Park in an integrated neighborhood. And I said, well, I think that would be a story. So that's how it started.
Yeah, we're speaking to Bill Dedman. He's an investigative journalist. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting about redlining in Georgia, bank lending to prospective homeowners, all the way back in the 1989. And we are talking to Bill as part of a series that we're doing, talking to the Georgia winners of Pulitzer Prizes. We're calling it Pulitzer Peaches, and we're doing this on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the Pulitzer Prize itself. And Bill, as a result of your reporting, or at least partially as a result of your reporting, some changes were made to the Federal Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, right?
Yes, yeah, so sort of all hell broke loose for a week or two there in Atlanta. You know, we had marches, we had breakfasts with the bankers where politicians made hay, calling them in to grill them. There was an effort to move some money into the black-owned banks in Atlanta, which did lend money in black neighborhoods and had practically a zero default rate. Then the Congress did change the law to increase disclosure of applications for loans. We had that information, for example, for the two biggest savings and loans in Atlanta. They were rejecting 5 or 10% of white applicants for home loans. That's people who've gone through the process, filled out an application, and they were rejecting 21 to 36% of black applicants. Now we have that information for every lender in America. So one of the things that this led to was more reporting by more journalists and think tanks and the Federal Reserve and others around the country, greater disclosure.
It's just a tremendous achievement for any investigative reporter, but it's particularly amazing when we consider the fact that you were 29 years old when you won the Pulitzer Prize. That must have been utterly life-changing. Do you remember the moment when you got the call?
Well, the main thing that stands out to me is that my son, just turned five. Justin had helped me color in the census tract map sitting on the floor of the art department at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, then on Marietta Street. And he misheard the announcement. And when he realized what we'd actually won, he was so upset because he thought we had won the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. And he was planning to buy the Atlanta Braves. That was his plan. You know, a word has to be said here for the editor at the Journal Constitution at that time, Bill Kovich, who was pushing back against the idea that we don't go where the business leadership is. There were good stories done at that time on Coca-Cola Company and others, and I saw proofs of little charts that ranked the banks on their lending in black and middle-income neighborhoods. And I saw those little charts being X'd out by one editor from the old regime on the proofs. That is, they come back and, well, we're going to show the general pattern, but let's not
name individual banks. We're going to call out specific banks that might want to advertise in our paper.
It's one thing to say the banks, and it's another thing to say Citizens and Southern and Bank South and... Bill Kovich was editing those charts back into the story with a very neutral tone, by the way. We didn't even call them bankers. If you go back and look, the stories are online called The Color of Money. And we didn't even call them bankers. Bill said, you know, people don't like bankers. It's a pejorative term. So we called them banking executives. The tone was a very neutral tone. And the stories were done as carefully as we could. But he was going to name names, and he deserves credit for that.
Absolutely. Investigative reporting is incredibly expensive. It generally, as an act unto itself, is a huge money loser for news organizations. The investigative capacity at the AJC has been tremendously diminished from back in the late 80s when you won your Pulitzer Prize, as it has at every major newspaper in the country. Do you think that you could have done this story if you'd been working at the paper today?
I think that good work has been done there. I have friends and colleagues there who I know have done good investigative work that you've reported on in the last few years. So it hasn't dried up. And, you know, this past summer, the national meeting of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Group, IRE, had its biggest attendance ever. And that wasn't just because we met in New Orleans. Good investigative reporting work is being done, especially with new tools, no longer the primitive database work that we were doing 30 years ago. With new tools and a lot of enthusiasm from young people, there's good investigative work being done even in an environment where your traditional news organizations have cut staff. But even when they've cut staff, often they realize that what distinguishes us from somebody who's just aggregating our content online is the investigative reporting.
In our last minute here, Bill Dedman, where is he now?
Oh, I'm at Newsday in New York, working on a story that we've been working on for more than a year. A team of four people sitting here working on a story that more than a year has gone by. And so don't tell us people aren't still doing serious investigative reporting based on public records. Carefully going through the information and then trying to find some way to tell it in the new ways, right? Video, online, maps, timelines, all the new tools, but still the same careful reporting. That's what we're trying to do.
All right. Well, fingers crossed for a second Pulitzer Prize for you. Bill Dedman is a senior investigative reporter at Newsday. As you just heard, he won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 1989 for his series on the discriminatory lending practices of Atlanta's bankers and bank executives, I should say, and the mortgage lenders as well. Bill, it's just been an honor to talk to you.
Thanks, Adam. It's a pleasure.
And you can hear all of the Pulitzer Peaches stories that we've been doing at gpbnews.org. Now, here's a very different story about banking. Atlanta-based Citizens Trust had more than 8,000 new accounts open in the month of July. That's a lot. Citizens Trust is one of the country's oldest African-American-owned banks. And that spike in new accounts is due in part to a new economic movement called Bank Black.
You can go to your bank tomorrow and you can say, until you as a corporation start to speak on our behalf, I want all my money.
Right.
And I'm taking all my money to Citizens Trust.
That's Atlanta rapper Killer Mike. On Second Thought, intern Olivia Rheingold spoke with a new applicant about why she decided to bank black.
I do consider banking black a movement. It is a way of recognizing the power that we may not recognize that we have. My name is Tiara Carter. I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm currently working as a nurse. I used to bank at SunTrust, so I'm moving my account from SunTrust to Citizens Trust Bank. I drove from Kennesaw to Atlanta to open up this account to support. Currently, you know, there's protesting going on, which is great, you know, a form of expression, but I think it's really important that we actually make moves that actually make a difference, and this is one of them. My mom taught me growing up, you always do something for a reason. And recently, and I really can't think of the guy's name that I saw on the internet, and he was talking about the money that we put in our churches actually go to white banks. But if I go to those banks to apply for a loan, then I'm often denied. And that kind of resonated in me, and it already supported the idea that I wanted to give back and support black-owned businesses. Everybody has their own motivation, and I was already motivated. And to see others motivated, it kind of gave me the will to drive 50 plus miles, you know, to open up the account. I'm not opening an account at a black-owned bank because I'm black, or because I'm black and they're black, that they will, you know, make shortcuts or look out for me. And opening this account at a black-owned bank is me supporting entrepreneurship of our community. That's my main goal. And I think it has a lot to do with educating ourselves. And that's very, very important. Again, to see where the money goes and see the effect that our money has. We have power. And I did not always recognize it. And it goes back to the Black Lives Matter movement. We shouldn't have to say it. A lot of people think, well, all lives matter. And it's like, yes, it does. But when we are targeted and we're dealing with issues as people of color, we have to be specific. And we have to call people out. And it's time to call people of color out for us to educate ourselves and realize the power that we have. And this is a monumental movement for us. Our money goes a long way. And it touches a lot of areas that we do not realize. So I think once we control our money and educate ourselves about our money and the effects and where it's going, we will be better as a unity. What I hope will happen now by putting my money in this bank is to be an everlasting statement. Not just we're all mad and upset of what is taking place right now. As my dad, the decisions you make will forever affect your life. And this is one of those decisions that is going to affect my life, my children, and my children's children.
That story was produced in partnership with NPR's Next Generation Radio. That's it for our show today, but as always, we want to hear from you. We talked earlier this hour about the chances that Georgia could turn purple in this year's presidential election. Do you think that Hillary Clinton could win Georgia this year? Is that something you see happening? Tell us your thoughts at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. You can also get in touch with us at OST Talk on Twitter, or you can post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Talk to you tomorrow.